For a team that drafts well, has really good scouts, the Jets do, it's good for them and for the Carolina Panthers. Hey, they weren't going to get, the way it looked, Deshaun Watson with what's going on there. And then you look at the draft, picking eighth, good luck. Three of the quarterbacks going 1, 2, 3. The fourth one could go fourth to Atlanta. Then you get to the fifth guy and somebody could trade up to get him before the eighth pick. So for Carolina, I think it's a great move for them.
When the Jets traded Sam Darnold to the Panthers on Monday, they threw all the subtlety out the window. Yes, the Jets are gonna draft a quarterback at number 2. And at the top of this draft, they're not alone. This year, for so many teams, it seems, salvation has to start under center, which has plunged mock drafts into utter chaos. Today, Field Yates breaks down the 5 NFL prospects who've been prophesied to be future franchise quarterbacks, and whether those projections should be mocked. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Wednesday, April 7th. This is ESPN Daily. Field, I want to ask you first off here, how is your dog dealing with his celebrity?
It's really gotten to his head, Pablo, which is a little bit disconcerting.
Field Yates is an NFL analyst and the host of the First Draft podcast. He's also been dealing with the fallout of his dog's quasi-cameo on live TV.
All of a sudden, our bed has gotten a lot smaller because we have a dog who decided that it's now his, this is his throne. And we hope that we can find some ways to knock him down a peg. In the meantime, it is still his world that we are living in.
So I need to explain this for people who aren't familiar, because a week ago, Field, more than just celebrity went to Cisco, your golden retriever's head. A lot more did. What exactly happened when you were taping NFL Live?
Yeah, so my wife was gone that day. So I was with Cisco by myself. If I closed the office door, Cisco just sat there and scratched and pawed until it was time for me to let him in. If I let him into the office, I ran into the vulnerability of him potentially tripping over wires. There's a handful of wires that are associated with our ESPN remote yes. setups. What I didn't realize was that a door C existed. Door C was not Cisco actually tripping over a wire or running into the camera, but rather him getting sick while laying right next to me in the middle of NFL Live and upchucking so violently that his head knocked into the camera. Cisco is totally fine. He swallowed a face wipe, ooh, and that was the root of the sickness. He has become very well known for his momentary incident on NFL Live.
So, Field, this is a safe space for you and for Cisco, and I bring you here because you're the perfect person to talk to right now. You've been grinding all manner of tape. You're incredibly detail-oriented. You have this encyclopedic knowledge of the NFL and now these prospects. And I want to start with the guy that you just did a deep dive into, Trevor Lawrence, because it feels like we're kind of rushing to find other people to become obsessed with, other names that maybe could rise all the way up the draft board. But you pretty clearly believe that this guy is special and is number one with a pretty obvious bullet.
What makes me so bullish about Trevor Lawrence, on top of this unique skill set, is that he has kind of already been living up to expectations in his career. He was billed as the top recruit coming out of his high school career. He played in Georgia. And you think about walking into a situation at Clemson, there was a senior quarterback already entrenched as a starter in Kelly Bryant. And Kelly was a pretty reasonable player as well. And Trevor, early in his freshman year, was called into action and never gave the job back. And in his 3 seasons as a starter, Trevor Lawrence helped Clemson to the college football playoff 3 straight years, and the team only lost 2 games that he started. So he's met expectations already at the college level, and now you fast forward to the NFL level, and it probably won't be as immediate because the Jaguars are not equipped to compete in the way that Clemson was with the pieces around Trevor Lawrence. But I think he's proven that in terms of moment and rising up to it, like, I think he is uniquely ready to do so in a way that other players who get drafted first overall are not as equipped to do.
So when the Jaguars take Trevor Lawrence, and I will say it that definitively, when they draft Trevor Lawrence come late April Fields, what talents are they getting alongside this wonderful mane of blonde hair?
It is wonderful, by the way. Lawrence kind of already has a tier unto himself in terms of quarterback hair rankings.
Yes.
On the field, I know there are people that find the word arm talent to be borderline alarming when discussing quarterbacks, but he is very talented as a thrower. That much is obvious. He's accurate on throws at the short to intermediate levels, and this is sort of throwing it back. But when Kurt Warner was making his rise, one of the things that his wide receivers would always talk about, Torrey Holt and Isaac Bruce most namely, would be if there was a run after catch opportunity, Kurt Warner was going to put the ball where it needed to be to create that run after catch opportunity.
So just so I understand arm talent, which is this vocabulary word that I feel like I'm going to start saying now, even though I'm absolutely the person who was like, that feels redundant.
Yeah.
Right? You have a good arm and you have a talented arm, but you also have arm talent. Explain why NFL people use that term and what it's supposed to entail.
Yeah, I think in some ways it actually might be a media contrived expression about quarterbacks.
Ooh.
And part of the reason why I mentioned how it's kind of a divisive term is, and I'll use an example, and Jamarcus Russell, the of course famed, or I guess infamous, Raiders number one overall pick out of LSU, had immense arm talent. I mean, I'm not sure you can think of a player who had more arm talent than Jamarcus Russell. But it's one thing to be able to make throws when you're standing in, you know, shorts and a t-shirt in a scripted environment, no defensive players, inside a dome where there's no wind or rain or snow or anything working against you. And I think that where you see arm talent work out in a player's favor is when they have that as part of a far more, you know, fulfilled skill set. And so, but I will say this, there aren't very many throws where the ball is traveling like 70 yards in the air. That matters like once a season, maybe on a Hail Mary situation.
Yeah, the Uncle Rico test isn't necessarily the most useful measure of how you're going to play in the actual game.
Yeah, and I think arm strength matters more. Like I call it almost like functional or applicable arm strength. And when you've got to make a throw that's not like 8 or 10 yards, it might be 28 or 30 yards, 35 or 40 yards. And you've got a wide receiver who's running full speed, and if you don't put the ball on a line, that receiver is just going to run right through the end zone. Or you've got a tight window over the middle of the field. You've got two converging defensive backs, but there is a window to throw it into. So I see a lot of that with Trevor. And I think the accuracy is really sort of special because you can go to any, really almost any of his games during his college career where you'll find plays where he's throwing on the run. You'll find plays where the play breaks down and he still makes something out of nothing. Or you'll find plays in the red zone, especially, where the dimensions can sometimes help the defense, right? You've got a natural boundary at the back of the end zone plus the sidelines. And Trevor's putting the football where only one player can make a play on it. And in that case, it's, of course, his own receiver.
When the play breaks down field, we've also seen Trevor, and I'm going to use this term. I don't think it's a real one, but I feel like it should be logically. It feels like we see a lot of his leg talent.
Yeah.
What's the deal with his leg talent?
I think the defining run of Trevor Lawrence's college career was the 2019 college football playoff semifinal against Ohio State when Trevor Lawrence ripped off like a 64-yard run where he is just zooming past Ohio State defensive backs and linebackers.
Lawrence took a peek downfield, had a lot of room, and breaks a tackle, and is still running. Lawrence in a foot race. Will they catch him? Touchdown, Tigers! Wow! A game-changing play.
This is Ohio State, right? Most of those guys, or many of those guys, are going to get drafted, in some cases, very high. So Trevor not only has the ability to be like an open field threat, but if you go back and watch Clemson, and they scored a lot of touchdowns, but he had plenty of running at or near the goal line. They can run these little read option plays where he's winning before the snap or right at the snap because he's got good football instincts and IQ as well. He's a really good athlete. And, you know, I can't say that being a great athlete is imperative for a quarterback right now. Tom Brady at 43, who runs a 5.27 40 or whatever it was coming out of Michigan, obviously is not a great open field athlete, but you did have eight quarterbacks last year run for at least 400 yards. And we saw players like Patrick Mahomes and Josh Allen and Justin Herbert and Lamar Jackson and Kyler Murray and Russell Wilson. And I'm just starting the list right there. Again, not an essential trait for a quarterback, but it feels very meaningful now given the landscape of starting quarterbacks in the NFL.
So we've tossed around many names. We've tossed around Kurt Warner, Patrick Mahomes, down the list. Who is the comp here, Field? Because I've heard it said that this is the best quarterback prospect since Andrew Luck. Is that what the conventional wisdom is at this point? Where do you land on all of that?
Yeah, I think the easy part of that question, I do believe, is Andrew Luck from 2012. So 9 years later, there hasn't been a quarterback prospect that stacks up going into the draft. Because as we know, there have been, you know, the Mahomes and Watsons and others of the world that have proven to be absolutely spectacular players once they've been drafted. So I think that Andrew Luck is probably the last quarterback prospect that we felt this way about going into the draft. One thing about Andrew Luck, and we saw this all the way from the start of his career until his emotional retirement ceremony, was that he just had an understanding, I think, of kind of what it took to be the face of the franchise and was prepared for the pressure that surrounded him. And I think that's something that I see actually in a handful of these quarterbacks in this pre-draft process. I think about that a lot with Justin Fields. He has this charisma that it's sort of like the steely charisma that really makes me think this guy is bound for superstardom as well. But Trevor Lawrence definitely exudes that when you sort of just see the way that he handles everything that's thrust upon him.
All right, Field, after the break, I want to get to all of those other quarterbacks who are intriguing to you and who also want the pressure of being the face of a franchise.
When you're on a business trip, you know what completely goes off the rails? Your workout routine, especially when you book a hotel that doesn't have a gym. So what ends up happening is you do a few push-ups and sit-ups in your room, run around the block, or just skip it entirely. Lame. If you just stay at La Quinta by Wyndham, you'll discover there's a fully equipped fitness center at every location. Now you can wake up and power your buys and tries the right way or de-stress with some cardio. The choice is yours. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book direct at LQ.com.
So, Field, beyond the Jags and Trevor Lawrence, there are four quarterbacks who are all expected to go in the first round, and this is where all of the chaos, all the moving parts come into play. So first, we had the Niners ending up with the third pick after this three-team switcheroo involving the Dolphins and the Eagles. Then on Monday of this week, the Jets go ahead and make their intentions clear by trading Sam Darnold to the Carolina Panthers, seemingly clearing the way for them to take a quarterback at pick number two. And we're not done yet, because our pal Adam Schefter is now confirming what Bill Barnwell had predicted on this podcast last week, which is that the Falcons are now deluged by trade calls and are open to moving their pick at number four. So, Field, taking a breath, it's late Tuesday afternoon. Do I have all of that right?
Yeah, you do have all that right, which, by the way the NFL draft works, Pablo, is that by the time many people are listening to this podcast, like nine more picks will have been traded, and we'll already have like the top seven teams having shifted order in some way, shape, or form. But as we currently stand, that's accurate.
So I want to get into the guy that most mock drafts have going number two to the aforementioned Jets, and that's Zach Wilson. And for those uninitiated into the cult of Zach Wilson and are kind of unfamiliar with his cryptocurrency-like rise, what do we need to know about the guy?
Yeah, so Zach Wilson's college career is kind of divided into two halves: pre-thumb injury and post-thumb injury. So he's from the state of Utah, wanted to go to Utah, and wound up at BYU instead because Utah never presented him with an offer to play there, which I think 4 years later they regret. And during the 2019 season, ends up suffering a right thumb injury. Not that like hurting your thumb typically makes a quarterback better. It just is this natural indicator where like his career kind of took off. But it really took off during his 2020 regular season. He ends up throwing 33 touchdowns and then actually cuts his interceptions down from 9 to 3. I tell you what, not only is he talented, he is so fun to watch, Pablo.
Wilson throws over the top, caught in the end zone.
What a throw.
a spin, a dive, and a score by Zach Wilson.
Zach Wilson is appointment television as a quarterback.
So the path is wide open officially, with the Jets trading Sam Darnold at long last to Carolina on Monday. So is this all a done deal to you? Are we about to see Wilson in green and white?
Yeah, for a while, Pablo, I was saying that the draft really starts at pick two. Well, now we kind of know what's going to happen at pick two in the draft. As while the Jets haven't confirmed anything, Jets GM Joe Douglas was asked following this trade of Sam Darnold about a quote from Steve Young, who referenced the Jets' affinity for Zach Wilson. And Joe, perhaps this was tongue-in-cheek, but he is, I mean, accurate in this assessment, noted that Steve, of course, our now analyst here at ESPN, is quite dialed in at BYU. Steve, one of the greatest players in BYU history. So whether you want to call that a tacit admission that the Jets are leaning towards Zach Wilson or not, logically, and all the buzz has been suggesting that it is going to be Zach Wilson who goes number two overall.
So we're at the number three overall pick now, and that is now owned by the San Francisco 49ers. And so I want to ask you here, Field, actually, what name should we be discussing at this spot? Is it Mac Jones or is it Justin Fields?
It feels responsible to be discussing Mac Jones because that seems to be where all the winds are blowing at this moment. I spent the week covering the Senior Bowl for us, and I spent that week studying, you know, we study as many players as you can, but it's only natural to gravitate towards some of the headliners. One of them was Mac Jones. And I remember at the end of the week tweeting as I was in the airport security line, basically, every year there's somebody at the Senior Bowl whose stock improves and sort of cements his status. And I felt like this year the answer was Mac Jones. And I remember at the time thinking to myself, man, am I going to regret that? If this guy doesn't even go to the Panthers eighth overall. And now it feels like he's going to be long gone by the time we get to pick eight. But the things that really stood out for Mac is that every player gravitated towards Mac Jones during that week. Mac was just the same player, just had this disposition throughout the week that was very steady and certainly stood out amongst the group of quarterbacks. Now, none of the other quarterbacks that were there are going to be drafted probably until round three at the earliest, but he really solidified himself amongst the six quarterbacks there.
So on one level, like, that does make sense because Mac Jones won a national title at Alabama. He was a Heisman finalist at Alabama. But it does seem also like we do this thing to Alabama quarterbacks. And I remember Tua Tagovailoa when he came out and it was like, look, those stats, we sort of got to like grade it on a curve because he was at Alabama and we don't know if that's going to translate. What does Mac Jones's college career tell you about how he's going to play in the NFL?
Yeah, so I think that there are some things that he didn't do that people in the NFL have come to appreciate. He didn't transfer. He was a third-string quarterback. And again, it's not like there were slouches in front of him. There was a second-round pick in Jalen Hurts and the fifth overall pick last year in Tua Tagovailoa. So he had to wait his turn. The big thing that we've been discussing with Mac Jones, if you're playing the game of one of these things is not like the other, and it's the five quarterbacks that we're talking about in the first round, it's Mac Jones the athlete because he is not nearly the athlete of a Trey Lance, Justin Fields, Zach Wilson, or Trevor Lawrence.
So let's get to Justin Fields now, because what did he run in his 40 that we just got wind of recently?
Yeah, so he runs like a 4.44 40, and he's like disappointed in it. It is absurd that like that would be in anybody's estimation or anybody's opinion a disappointment. But I love Justin Fields, and he is, I mentioned earlier, he's got this sort of steeliness about him where he's just unfazed. We can point to the highest moment of his college football career at Ohio State where against Clemson in the college football playoff semifinals, he gets nearly broken in half.
Third and 13, Fields does have time and now takes off, makes a cut, hits a hard hit by Skalski who knocks him down. 2 yards short, and Fields is still down.
And he bounces back and just never skips a beat. He throws 6 touchdowns, including 2 just moonshots down the field, takes hits throughout the game, and he just, every time they pan to Justin Fields, never too high, never too low. I think that consistency that you saw in his disposition resonates with teammates. He has a massive arm. He is just built like an ox too. And I think he ended up weighing somewhere around 220 or 225 pounds, but he certainly didn't run like a guy that only weighed 215 to 225 pounds. I think there's a chance that he could be the kind of player that at his apex is consistently throwing for 30 plus touchdowns and challenging for 6 to 10 rushing touchdowns every year as well.
So the next and last name I want to get to with you here among the quarterbacks is Trey Lance. He's a mystery, kind of, playing out of North Dakota State. Where did he come from? What should we know about him?
Yeah, so North Dakota State is the best program at the Division I AA, which is now the FCS.
Yes.
We know the program from, obviously, Carson Wentz, 2016, number 2 overall pick, now in the Indianapolis Colts. But Mel Kiper Jr. has frequently referred to Trey Lance as, you know, the most unique evaluation, sort of the biggest wild card in his career.
Mm.
So separate and apart from the fact that he played at an FCS school, which you're always projecting, right? I mean, the schools that he's playing against, we know much more likely from the NCAA basketball tournament. He's got games against like Butler and South Dakota State, right? Like he ends up starting his redshirt freshman year. He threw for 41 touchdowns and 0 interceptions. Again, competition is different. But think about how incredibly difficult it is to finish a season with like less than 3 or 5 interceptions at the college level. He had 0. It spoke to me of a guy that has a confidence in his decision making. Now, what makes the evaluation complicated this year is that North Dakota State played 1 game. They played against Central Arkansas in the middle of this last college football season, and Trey Lance was not at his best.
Lance again, down the seam, and it's intercepted!
This was a 1-game season, almost for the express purpose of showcasing Trey Lance, right?
That's almost literally, and I'm sure they would take us to task on that, but there was certainly motivation to see Trey Lance play this year because he has a chance to be the highest drafted player in program history other than Carson Wentz. And he does not play his best during that game, but there's too much good stuff from the year before and too much raw ability that, like, even if he just went and saw his pro day, to not be really enamored by Trey Lance. He is a bulldozer. My favorite play of Trey Lance's college career came in the national championship game when he played in 2019. And there was a play where it looked like it was going to break down or he was going to get tackled for like a modest 1-yard gain.
Second down and 9. Under heat. Shows his escapability. Took a hit and stayed on his feet. And the pack moving beyond the first down. A herd couldn't bring down Trey Lance.
It was actually a rugby scrum by the end of it. And it turned into a 15-yard run. And it reminded me that, you know, part of what you're doing when you're scouting players below the Division I level is looking for guys that are simply different from the rest of the players on the field. And Trey Lance is simply different than almost every other player that he played with or against on the field.
All right, Field. So I'm looking at the draft order here. If Trevor Lawrence is going number 1 to Jacksonville, we feel confident about that. We feel confident about Zach Wilson going number 2 to the Jets. Where do the cards all fall for Mac Jones and Justin Fields and Trey Lance?
There's a bit of a risky business involved when you start to believe everything you hear during the pre-draft process, but a lot of momentum has been pointing towards the 49ers being very interested in taking Mac Jones 3rd overall. Mac Jones would seem likely to end up in San Francisco with that 3rd overall pick. So I think the 4th quarterback to go off the board has a chance to go 4th overall, which obviously is very uncommon to see 4 quarterbacks to begin the draft. As you mentioned earlier via Shefty, the Falcons are being bombarded with trade calls about that 4th overall pick. The decision they have to make is whether the opportunity cost is too rich to pass up. They may not be equipped to be taking a first-round quarterback that's really good for a while because they have the 4th pick after a tremendously down year. On the other hand, while Matt Ryan is not the player he was during his MVP season, if you have a new head coach who does believe enough in him that he could be a 2 or 3 year starter, maybe you'd feel better about taking a skilled player at 4th overall or trading back. So one way or another, I do believe a quarterback is going fourth overall, and I'll give you Trey Lance in that spot because I arbitrarily flipped a coin, which leaves us with one last of those top five quarterbacks. And this is where things get interesting. We don't believe 5, 6, or 7 currently owned by Cincinnati, Miami, or Detroit will be a quarterback pick. Same thing with Carolina at pick 8, which leaves the Denver Broncos as one of the wild card teams here. I do believe that they both have a quarterback need, and because they're at 9, the price to pay to move up isn't as aggressive as it would be for a team like the Patriots at pick 15 to move up. So give me the Denver Broncos as the landing spot for the 5th quarterback, whether that's Trey Lance or Justin Fields.
Field Yates, thank you for all of your, I'm going to coin a term here that I hope you use on television. I thank you for your brain talent.
Wow. Okay, that's like probably the nicest thing anybody's ever said about me. And I might get that tattooed somewhere. Maybe like on the back of my head. So if I ever go bald, it'll say, at least I've got brain talent.
Okay, up next. The man behind the most interesting and occasionally most infuriating man at this year's Masters.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code DAILY. That's code DAILY. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
Here's another story I want you to know. More than any other course, Augusta National is this sanctum of golf tradition. A sanctum that might just get defaced this week, in one way or another, by the most explosive name in the entire sport, Bryson DeChambeau. Our pal Sam Borden has been reporting on DeChambeau and his caddy, Tim Tucker, ahead of the Masters, which tees off tomorrow. So we called Sam up to discuss. So Sam, you've been working on this story about Bryson DeChambeau and his caddy, Tim Tucker. But before we can understand the fascinating dynamic of their relationship, I just want you to explain for us why DeChambeau is this compelling and polarizing and even infuriating figure around golf. How would you describe what his deal is?
Yeah, it's Pablo, it's a really interesting thing. I mean, I guess the best way to say it is golf's been around since like the 1400s. And in the 600 plus years since then, nobody has come at the sport in the way that Bryson DeChambeau does.
When I was younger, my dad always would tell me to try and hit weird wedge shots or weird iron shots around trees, make weird golf swings. I became very good at adapting to the situation. And that was mainly a result of my dad teaching me it's okay to try things and mess up because it makes you more resilient.
This is a guy who challenges literally everything about the game. You know, most golfers use a set of irons that are progressively longer as you go from the shortest wedge to the longest driver. DeChambeau uses clubs that are all the same length. Most golfers bend down behind the ball to read the green and look at it with their eyes. DeChambeau uses his feet and vectors and math and physics. Like, he has come at the sport of golf essentially with the idea that he's going to break the game and put it back together. And in a sport that is so much about tradition, obviously, as you can imagine, that hasn't necessarily sat perfectly with everybody who's in the game.
And the other detail about him just visually, Sam, is that lots of golfers, they tend to not be jacked. They tend to not be 6'1", 245. But this dude who is nicknamed the scientist for the reasons you alluded to, he is also like physically pretty atypical.
No doubt about it. As the pandemic kicked in and lockdowns began, DeChambeau decided, all right, well, this is the time I'm going to reevaluate what I'm going to do with my game. And the thing that he decided to change was his body. And so he's literally put on like 40, 45, 50 pounds of muscle and not coincidentally is now driving the ball 40, 45, 50 yards longer than he was before. I mean, it'd be like a quarterback who can throw the ball 90 yards in the air. It just doesn't happen, but it's happening now in golf with Bryson DeChambeau.
Yeah, it just, when I think of what he used to look like, Sam, correct me if I'm wrong here, but I envision like Steve Rogers, Captain America before like the super soldier program. And now here he is walking around breaking the entire sport.
No, totally. And he's all about like the idea that he's a disruptor, you know, like he's come out and talked about how he wants to live to be 140 years old. And there are a lot of golfers who look at him and say like, dude, what are you talking about? But the truth is right now, there are a lot of golfers who coming off of DeChambeau's win at Winged Foot in the US Open in the fall are looking at their own games and saying, maybe I should be doing it a little more like this guy.
I just love that there is an athlete who is trying to live to 140. And Tom Brady, meanwhile, is like, you thought I was insane. Meanwhile, here is Bryson DeChambeau trying to basically defy every actuarial chart that exists in life and in sports. And so now, Sam, I kind of want to understand, like, how does this guy pick a caddy?
Yeah, it's a tricky thing, and there's no doubt about it. And I think it's important to understand, too, that the relationship between a player and a caddy, particularly at professional golf's level, isn't just about what happens during the 18 holes of a golf round. These guys spend hours together. They travel on the road. They spend weeks at a time. Essentially, they're each other's family. And Tim Tucker, he's known Bryson since Bryson was 15 years old. And he knows what goes into making Bryson tick. And in this case, that's almost as important as being able to read the green or pick the right club.
So how did these two guys meet and bond at the very beginning?
It goes back to when Bryson was a teenager and Tim Tucker was teaching a green reading class, a class about reading greens that uses a system called vector reading. And Bryson, at 15 years old, took that class. And Tucker told me that literally they taught six classes, like 6 days in a row at the same course in California. And Bryson showed up for the first one, and then showed up for the second one and the third one and the fourth one and the fifth one. And by the last day, he was basically helping them teach the class because he had taken in so much of the information. This kid is something different. Like, who knows whether he's going to make it or not make it, but whatever he does, he's going to go about it in a different way. And Tucker found that appealing.
I am curious what kind of a background that someone like Tim needs to be getting the respect of a guy like Bryson DeChambeau, who is very rigorous about his science.
Totally. It was one of the first questions that I asked him. I said, are you a math wizard?
No, I'm not. No, I went to high school. I didn't go to college. I failed pre-algebra. We have a joke. The smartest player has the dumbest caddy.
And actually, I mean, he went on to explain that he went into the military and some of the formulas that he and Bryson use to calculate things like air density, he actually is familiar with because those are the similar kinds of formulas that you use to figure out how to aim a sniper's rifle.
So to take the sweep of their personalities here and the chemistry between them, why do you think these two are such a good fit together, Sam?
You know, there was a point fairly early in Bryson's career where he actually took a break from Tim Tucker and Bryson tried somebody else. And I think he found very quickly that it's not an easy position to fill. And so after about 6 months, he called Tucker back and brought him back. And I think he realized that he needs somebody who is as curious as he is. He needs somebody who is as willing to challenge the accepted wisdom. That's what makes them work.
It's pretty cool how unique Tim is in regards to the fact that he has that same mindset of determination, hard worker, and wants to find the best way to do something.
Did you ever have any moments where you were kind of like, is this really going to help?
There was a time where I thought, you know, this guy may be a little crazy. And, you know, every time, I hate to say it to him, or, you know, if he hears this, most of the time he's right.
So what should we be watching out for from Bryson and from Tim as they go to work together at the Masters this weekend, Sam?
Well, more of the same. They're already challenging things again. Bryson talked this week already about how he's got a new driver head in his bag.
There's something in the bag this week that's very helpful. I won't go into specifics of it, but just know this has been a few years in the making, and I'm very excited for it.
Obviously, he's reevaluating the status quo for what is the accepted wisdom to play Augusta National.
Sam Borden, I'm doing some back of the envelope math here. Bryson DeChambeau was 27 years old. Okay, so I look forward to you covering this story for the next 113 years.
Well, you know, Pablo, they say that golf is a sport you can play forever. And I think Bryson obviously is going to try to challenge that and take it quite just as far as he can.
I'm Pablo Torre. This has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.